crawling behind the gate. The gate swings into the stretch, and here they come. They're horsing around.
Welcome to Horsing Around. I'm Michelle Gatchel. I'm here with my co-host, Kelly Bell. And we have a great guest today. We're going to talk to Jamie Jackson, who is a natural horse healthcare specialist. And so what does that mean? Well, he's written a book, actually several books, to tell us all about it. And I can't wait to hear. I think we're going to learn so much. I mean, the whole concept is the idea that when our horses are in the wild, they don't get a lot of the sicknesses that horses in captivity get. So if you study the horses in the wild, maybe you can figure out what we're not giving to horses in captivity that help prevent them from getting diseases and illnesses and infections that they're getting in captivity that they never get in the wild. Welcome, Jamie Jackson.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here and talk about what I do.
So Jamie, gosh, natural horse care. Sounds like, why wouldn't you have natural horse care, right?
Yes, true.
But what are people doing that in the regular world, so to speak, that maybe they aren't using natural horse care?
Well, my work with horses began way back in the 1970s. I was a farrier for about 7-8 years when I ran into my first wild horse. It was a client's horse. And what I noticed right off the bat were their hooves, since that's what I was dealing with. And I've not seen anything quite like them. They were rather extraordinary, what we would call unblemished and highly polished. But I'd never seen anything like it before. The conformation of the hoof was different than what I had been taught, what I had seen. So being the sort of person that I am, I decided to go to wild horse country. Mm-hmm. And then out there I went and to look at their hooves. And then I suddenly realized I don't know anything about the species out there. So I had a bit of learning to do and connecting with the government that sort of supervises them. And then eventually I ended up in the Bureau of Land Management corrals, the BLM corrals, up in northeastern California, where I did a sort of an extensive study of their hooves. I measured 1,000 of them. Mm. And so I would have useful data to connect to what I'm doing with domestic horses. Out of that came what we call natural hoof care, and the natural trim specifically. And then at the same time, I needed to know how do the hooves get like that?
Yeah.
Which means I got to go back into the back country. And I spent about 4 years in and out of wild horse country, getting to know the horses, sort of trekking along with them.
And where was this?
In Nevada for the most part. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from them about behavior, how they move, how their eating habits and all these things. And out of this emerged this broader picture of natural horse care, as I saw it.
Yeah.
So then the problem was, how do I take all this information and make it useful to horse owners? Okay. Not easy. Because I remember the first time I came out in 1982, and I went to one of my clients and said, we're going to do a wild horse trim on your horse. And she just screamed out, no, you're not. We're not putting anything wild on my horse. So that's how, so I went home. I was sort of traumatized by that. This is such good news. And they're telling me no.
Yeah.
So that's how the term, the natural trim, came about. Mm-hmm. I had to think about that.
I want to explore this just a little bit more. I'm kind of smooth brained on this. When I was a child, there was a pony that lived right across the street from my grade school. And this horse's hooves had grown and kind of curled under, and it was all deformed. I mean, you know, it was awful. But yet wild horses live their entire lives and never have that happen. Can you explain to me why we have this problem with domesticated horses and we don't have them with wild horses? and then get into a little bit about the differences between traditional shoeing techniques and a wild trim.
Well, let's see, that's the people don't know what is natural for the horse unless you go into an environment where we call it their adaptive environment. You wouldn't know. There are horses running wild in all sorts of biomes that are not natural for them, and they have the sorts of problems that you're describing with the hooves. But when you put them in their natural habitat, we call their adaptive environment, then you begin to see an entirely different picture. That's what I looked at. So I had to make this connection with people between what it's supposed to look like, which is an abstraction to them because they've never seen it, and what they're saying with problematic, with problems in the feet, whether from laminitis or navicular syndrome or whatever. So there was no model before that to look at. And so in 1982, I was in this position of having to bring something into the horse world that they never seen before. So when you understand how they live in the wild, how much they move, the way in which they move, and you go back into domestication and you see the hooves that have are in these grotesque states of deformity, then you begin to see there's a bigger picture, and that is how they live, their life experiences. And so I begin to write books about all of that. Okay. Is
But
that
in that natural, living, like if we've talked to people out at is it Chincoteague Island, Kelly? Did I say that right?
Chincoteague, yeah.
Yeah, and those horses, it's a marshy, grassy, hilly area on this island, but it's not rough. It's not rocky rough, right? So how do they keep their little hooves from not growing around and being funky? You know what I'm saying? Like, what is it that's rubbing them or that they're eating that isn't making it grow so fast?
I'm familiar with those horses, and they are trimmed, and they
Oh.
are culled, and they are managed in a way that is not natural for their species. You go to
Oh.
the Great Basin, and there's nobody out there giving them hoof care or giving them vaccinations or anything. They live off the land, and they do that 24/7. The Chincoteague horses, the Assateague, those islands, they're in a sandy biome, and their hooves are very problematic. I've seen them and talked with the biologists that are involved with that. So there's what we call an adaptive environment, the one where the species came out of. And that's been looked at by scientists. And so it's a pretty big picture. So it comes down to what they're eating. And one of the veterinarians in our organization went out. She wanted to see where they live, and she went out and says, "Holy mackerel, this is like this is completely different than anything she had ever imagined. The habitat, what they're eating, those are unexplored parts of the natural state of the horse." And I've been sort of preaching for almost 40 years now that scientists need to be looking at exactly what they're eating and create formulations that would help horse owners have horses that are not laminitic, for example. And does that kind of answer your question? We can delve into the specifics as far as you want.
But so one of the things that came out of all this, besides your training, is you also have a book, The Paddock Paradise, recently, A Guide to Natural Horse Boarding, so that when you have your horse boarding, you can make it as natural as possible for them. So let's talk about a little bit about what that means.
Okay. Paddock Paradise is something that distilled right out of my studies of wild horses as a concept. And for years, I tried to explain that to people, and they didn't get it. And part of that was just my inability at the time to, I didn't write about it. I just would talk with people about it. So, so I eventually, how it started was some people I knew got to know out of Georgia, their horse, one of their horses had become, had foundered pretty bad. And they didn't know what to do. And so I thought, well, here's an opportunity for me to create this tracking system. There was no book yet. So there was, I conjured up the name Paddock Paradise. It's sort of an oxymoron. I put it on a green cover for grass that could cause laminitis. And here's a horse walking down this path. So the whole idea was to get the horse out of the care practice was caused the laminitis, and so the husband and wife worked diligently on it, put this thing together. That was the first Paddock Paradise. And so I was just sitting there, and they gave me photographs. That's the one of the horses right there in the book. And
what was his name?
I don't remember.
That's okay.
So they even brought their neighbor's horses to go in there, and away they all went. Aww. So I was sitting there one day, and all of a sudden it just came to me. I'll call it Paddock Paradise. Mm-hmm. Stuck. Okay. You know,
in this picture, that some people, if they just hear the podcast, they can't really see it. But the difference is there are dirt paths that the horses can go on to stay off of the grass all the time.
Exactly. The tracking system includes all the things they need to live healthfully. Mm-hmm. They take the shoes off, and what happens almost immediately is the hooves begin to change. They begin to, what I call their mass migrations into the wild horse hoof conformation. And the natural trim supports that. Those changes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't cause them, it facilitates them.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much. You know, I want to have you back next week so we can talk more about how people can change their paddock and stable spaces to let their horses live more naturally. But coming up next, we are going to hear from Jay Wolf and Keith Gisser on their top contenders for the jug. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
With more than 300,000 horses in Ohio, the economic impact of the equine industry in the state is over $1.4 billion. Much of that value comes from standardbred horse owners, breeders, trainers, and drivers who participate in the sport of harness racing. The mission of the Ohio Harness Horsemen's Association is to preserve, protect, promote, and serve the entire standardbred industry in Ohio and beyond. To learn more about the Ohio Harness Horsemen's Association, go to OHHA.com. That's OHHA.com.
It's mud season. Are you looking for a fix in a muddy situation? Cashman's has you covered, offering innovative mud control solutions. We are also your number one source for the best deals on rubber mats for multi-use flooring, perfect for horse stalls, garages, and gyms. Cashman's Horse Equipment has been serving the equine community for over 40 years. Come and visit our location in Delaware, Ohio, and shop over 10 acres of equine farm and livestock supplies. Shop online anytime at cashmans.com.
Be sure to catch the new podcast, The Top of the Stretch, presented by the Ohio Harness Horsemen's Association. The podcast keeps fans of racing in the Buckeye State up to date on various topics concerning the sport of harness racing. The news and views of top officials, owners, trainers, drivers, and breeders in Ohio. That's the all-new podcast, Top of the Stretch, on the Facebook page of the Ohio Harness Horsemen's Association. Be there!
Welcome back to Horsing Around. I'm Michelle Gatchell, and we got our Road to the Little Brown Jug segment with Keith Gisser and Jay Wolf. Hey, gentlemen.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Great. Gosh, Jay, you put together a list every week of horses and how they're doing. And this leads up to the jug and who we might see in that race, right?
That's correct. I think this is about the sixth or seventh year I put together a top 10 list of the horses that are eligible for the Little Brown Jug. Obviously, we're not 100% sure who's going to commit or enter the race at this point, but we can talk at least talk about the top 10 horses that are eligible to enter the Little Brown Jug.
All right. Well, I'll let you two go to it.
All right. And actually, I've been doing a top five. I actually started a little bit before Jay did. I think Jay likes to wait till the Hamiltonian finishes so the jug can get the clear path to the PR move. And we're actually pretty much on the same page, Jay. So talk about your first two horses. Perfect Sting, you have number one. Rocky Road had over number two. I'm the other way around. I've got Rocky Road number one, Perfect Sting number two. But I really think, and I don't know how you feel, this year, I feel like we've got the most balanced group of three-year-olds. Any one of them could step up. And as of this particular moment, there's just not a dominant horse in the group.
You're 100% right, Keith. You know, I think they've all taken their chance to be the top of the list at this point. But, yeah, I do have Perfect Sting number one, undefeated as a two-year-old. And, you know, hasn't come back quite the way they expected. But Joe Holloway is a Hall of Fame trainer, and David Miller always seems to get the trips he needs around Delaware. Rocky Road Hanover, I have number two. I spoke to Tony Alanya last week, and he's very excited about this colt, especially on the half. He thinks he'll excel on the half mile track at Delaware.
Okay, and yeah, like I said, I've just got him flipped just because Rocky Road has beaten Perfect Sting the last couple of times. But again, if you look at the overall body of work for the season, you can make an argument for either of them. You've got Southwind Gendry number three. This is a Ron Burke trainee, and you talk about Delaware, Ohio, and Ron Burke. There's got to be something there. I've got Southwind Gendry actually number four behind Lawless Shadow. Lawless Shadow is, of course, the horse who was placed to the winner of the Meadowlands Pace when Charlie May was disqualified. He got absolutely fried in his last start, parked every step in the mile. So I'm going to excuse that one. I think that he fits pretty well. But let me ask you something while we're on that topic. You have American Courage fourth on your list. I do not list American Courage because he would have to supplement. Explain to folks how the current supplement rule works, something exciting that's going to be happening coming up in the future as well.
Yeah, you're right, Keith. To be eligible for the Little Brown Jug, you have to make payments when the horse is a yearling, as a two-year-old, and then earlier this year when they're a three-year-old. If at any point you do not make or miss one of those payments, you are ineligible to race in the Little Brown Jug. However, our current rules state that if you win one of the major races, which we have identified as the Cane Pace, the Messenger Pace, the North America Cup, and the Meadowlands Pace, any horse that wins one of those four races that is not jug eligible can enter the jug for a $45,000 payment. This year, American Courage was not eligible, and based on his win in the Messenger Stakes, he is now Little Brown Jug eligible with that $45,000 payment. Starting next year, the conditions will be that any horse that is not eligible to the Little Brown Jug can enter for a $45,000 payment. So we're removing the caveat that you have to win one of the four classic events to enter the jug. So that is exciting. You know, unfortunately, we're a year too late. Anytime you make a rule change, it takes basically 3 years to implement, because it will only affect the horses that are born this year. So,
right.
We have a horse here in the state of Ohio by the name of Charlie May, who last week at the Milstein in Cleveland set a world record, and unfortunately is not eligible for the Little Brown Jug. And I know owner Don Tiger entered his horse in the Messenger and finished second. He crossed the finish line first in the Meadowlands Pace, what was disqualified and placed ninth due to interference. So I have a feeling that if we had the open supplement this year, that Mr. Tiger would have his checkbook out already.
I don't have a feeling he would. There's no doubt in my mind that Don would do that. Let me ask you a hypothetical here, Jada. I don't know what the time frame is. They're appealing that ruling, that interference ruling, and there's no word on when a hearing is going to be held. As far as the jug is concerned, if they were to win an appeal before entries were due for the jug, and he were to be declared the winner of that race, would he then be eligible to supplement?
Yes, we've notified Mr. Tiger that if the New Jersey Commission ruling occurs before our entry, which is the Monday of jug week, you know, we'll be more than glad to accept his entry.
Okay, so I mean, quite frankly, I don't know how you feel. If I was doing a top 10, and if Charlie May had not been disqualified from the Meadowlands Pace, he would probably be the number one horse at the top in the road to the jug. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the Harness Racing Communications division of the USTA puts out a top 10 list, and Charlie May, who I believe was seventh this week, and he is the highest rated top 3 year old pacer on the list. So I think you're 100% right. If Charlie May was jug eligible or happened to win the Messenger, he would be number one at the, you know, or number two at the worst.
Okay. So we're pretty much on the same page. Let's go ahead and go through the rest of your list here quickly. We mentioned Lawless Shadow, who you have at number five on your list. A Buck About Hanover is a horse who looked really sharp earlier this year. He's leveled off a little bit, but he comes from the Tony Lanya barn, another stable that seems to have horses ready to go when they need to be. Again, he's kind of right now the number two horse in the barn behind Rocky Road. And earlier in the season, those roles were reversed.
Yeah, a Buckabet is a very large horse. I know Tony gave him some time off. He did not enter him into the cane. He just said he wanted to give him some time off. And I saw a report recently that he trained real well. So Tony Alanya will have him ready if he's entered in the jug.
Yeah, and if he chooses to go. The rest of your list, number seven, you've got a horse that I'm not that familiar with, Bongiorno's horse, Water Sports Team. It's one of those horses that seems like kind of hangs around every week, doesn't have the real big signature win, but it's one of those horses who's highly, highly competitive. And with the jug being a two-heat race, I feel like this is the kind of horse who might step up, not necessarily with a win in the limb, but with the right draw in a final where he could surprise.
Yeah. Water Sports Teen was originally owned by Black Magic Racing here in Central Ohio. Mr. Gravener from Michigan purchased this horse from the Luthers in July. So he has been in the Bongiorno barn for about 5 or 6 weeks and has four wins and was third up at Northfield Park in
right.
Milstein last weekend.
Yeah, then we've got 1-800, Nancy Factor trainee, owned by Brixton Medical. I think to me, after number eight, when we get into number nine, Town Gossip, number 10, My Sweet Boy Max, those two seem to be a drop below the other two. Those top eight seem to be the top tier to me. I don't know how you feel about it, but I think when we get to start getting into 9 and 10, we're looking at a could be almost anybody type situation.
Honestly, every week I have a top 20, 25 list. I'll go through the top 25 horses. I follow them weekly at this point, but you're right. I mean, we could have had the top 15 and you could put 15 in number the nine hole. Town Gossip recently raced in the New York Sire Stakes and did well. So I left him at nine. And My Sweet Boy Max, first time in the list, was second in the Milstein, and so he raced fairly well too in the Adios over
right.
in Pennsylvania. So.
And of course, being second in the Milstein, the significance of that, good effort on a half mile track like the Delaware Fairgrounds.
That's correct.
How hard is it, or how much harder is it for you these days now? And again, you just started doing this list a few years back, so you really haven't had the references. You know, back in the old days, when we started handicapping the jug, yeah, back in the old days when you were a kid, I see you smiling, Jay. You know, we had the Confederation Cup at Flamborough. We had the Adios, which was race to limbs in a final on the same day. So you had a chance to do a little bit of handicapping as to which horse might be put together well to go two heats. As you're compiling your list, you give that any thought at all, or you just look at their basic performance as it shows on paper?
Well, the Little Brown Jug is the last event to go heat,
right.
So there is no way to put that in your handicapping. I really think about a half mile track more than I do the heats. You know, Lawless Shadow, Ian Moore trains up in Ontario on a half mile track there. He was down here at Scioto Downs and I watched him a couple times earlier this year and was absolutely incredible in overnight company at Scioto Downs. You know, horses like a Buckabet Hanover, the larger they are, the more concerned I am about them getting around the half. Hall of Fame driver John Campbell told me one time, he goes, I wish people would stop referring the Little Brown Jug as a half-mile track because it's a 5/8-mile track in a half-mile oval. The way the turns are banked,
he right.
says, if your horse can get around the 5/8, your horse can get around Delaware, end of story. So, you know, a little bit of concern there. A little bit of a schedule change this year. in the classic races, the North America Cup, which is held at Mohawk Park up at in Ontario. Their finals traditionally Father's Day weekend, and they moved it to the Olympics will be on Labor Day weekend, and the final will be on December or on September 11th. So that's kind of butts up right against the little brown jug. So a little concern there with that. However, the Ohio Sire Stakes, the New York Sire Stakes, and the Pennsylvania Sire Stakes will occur on those weekends as well. So may have been a little short-sighted on the folks from the North America Cup to move it. But, you know, obviously that'll be a real telltale sign about how well these horses are coming into Delaware.
And of course, unfortunately, Ontario, they just had all kinds of COVID issues that really affected that, right? Had they tried to race that race in June, they almost probably could not have raced it. So, I mean, what they did there, it was almost out of necessity, unfortunately. All I know is this, Jay, it's going to be a lot different than it was last year, and I'm certainly looking forward to it. I know you guys missed your big 75th celebration. Anything special coming up for 75 version 2.0 this year?
Well, you know, some of the plans that we had for the 75th, we're going to continue. We're looking forward to working with the Ohio Harness Horsemen's Association. They're going to be taking over the speaker series that the USTA did for a number of years. We're looking for, you know, our original plan was to invite all the former winning drivers back. And obviously with travel restrictions still from Ontario, it's going to become difficult. But I always say we're going to put on a good show regardless of if it's 74, 75, or 76. So we invite everyone to come out on September 23rd for the 76th edition.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. We'll certainly catch up with you again between now and then at least once, if not a couple of times. And obviously, we may have some weeks where there's not a whole lot of changes. We'll just have to wait and see. But depending on how things change as we go forward, and the bottom line is, folks, it's going to be an exciting jug. It is a wide-open affair. Keep checking Jay Wolf's Road to the Little Brown Jug, or Top Jug Contenders. I call it the Road to the Little Brown Jug. And I'll keep updating mine as well. Thanks a lot for being with us, Jay.
Thank you, Keith.
And that concludes this edition. We'll see you next week for some more Horsing Around.